From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, and Catherine Gibson, VOA congressional correspondent. Welcome, Kimberly and Catherine.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, here are the issues. U.S. President Joe Biden was in Philadelphia on Tuesday to urge the passing of voting rights legislation that has stalled in Congress, but he did not outline a path to overcome Republican opposition. The speech came as Republicans in state legislatures sought to pass measures restricting access to voting. Biden's remarks came a day after Texas Democrats arrived in Washington to prevent their GOP-controlled legislature of passing a bill to place new restrictions on voting in the state. Also, President Biden met with Senate Democrats on Capitol Hill after the lawmakers announced an agreement on a $3.5 trillion plan to expand spending on health care for the elderly, climate change, and programs to help families. One of the Haitian American men arrested on suspicion of taking part in the assassination of Haiti's president last week had been an informant to the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, a DEA official has said. The arrested suspect, identified as 63-year-old Christian Emmanuel Sannon, entered the country on a private jet in June, said Police Chief Leon Charles at a news conference. Meanwhile, the interim prime minister confirms a request has been made for U.S. troops to be sent to the country. The Biden administration is reportedly reviewing that request. Amid the largest anti-government protest in decades in Cuba, President Biden is expressing support for the people of the Caribbean island nation, underscoring their right to peaceful protests. The rare anti-government demonstrations began last Sunday when thousands took to the streets in protest over food and medicine shortages, price hikes, and the government's handling of COVID-19. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Catherine, I'll start with you. The lawmakers who arrived in the nation's capital on Monday night said they were prepared to stay in Washington out of the reach of Texas law enforcement until a special legislative session concludes early next month. What does this action signal regarding politicians and the voting rights issue?
That's right. Well, I think it gave some renewed attention to these voting rights pieces of legislation that have frankly been stalled up on Capitol Hill up until this point. Having those Texas Democrats there and having Vice President Kamala Harris meet with them gave some more attention to the way these issues are playing out in states across the country. And we know that in Texas, a special legislative session was called by the Republican governor there in an attempt to pass legislation that Texas Democrats say is restrictive and restricts the voting rights in particular of minorities in that state. So we saw them in a very media-friendly moment flee the state to avoid arrest for not showing up for that vote, come to Washington, D.C., and really meeting with other Democrats to push them and say, this may have stalled up on Capitol Hill, but you need to pass this now because we are facing a crisis situation in Texas.
Well, also this legislation known as For the People Act would create national standards for voting that could roll back some of the restrictions that have been approved or are advancing in Republican-led states, including Texas. Kimberly, why are politicians saying this legislation is needed now?
The For the People Act, as well as the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. There's a lot of initiative from the Democrats to try to protect voting rights across the country, especially in light of the Supreme Court kind of dialing back the ability of the federal government to enforce certain components of the actual Voting Rights Act and making it harder for people who feel their rights are being disenfranchised to take states and local governments to court for these restrictions. And so the court even has said that it is up to Congress to make these changes. And so one of the reasons the Texas Democrats were there were that they said this is only a stalling mechanism. They can't stay in Washington forever. The Texas governor has said that he'll just keep calling special session after special session until the law gets passed. The issue is a numbers game. The Democrats don't have enough support in the Senate to get this over the finish line at the moment, especially not without undoing the filibuster, which President Biden has not gotten behind.
So I'll just throw this out to both of you. Where does the Biden administration stand regarding the actions of the Democrats and the Republicans' response?
Well, Vice President Kamala Harris has praised the actions of those Texas Democrats, calling them courageous, and has met with them while they've been in Washington, D.C. She's also working with private leaders to try and form a coalition to keep pushing these voting rights legislation, pieces of legislation through, really. But as Kimberly mentioned, the issue of the filibuster is the real block here. And if the filibuster isn't removed, then we simply don't have the numbers in the U.S. Senate to get that through.
In mentioning this filibuster, many Democrats have expressed frustration with the lack of a greater White House push to change this, with civil rights activists stressing that Biden was elected with broad support from African Americans, whose votes they say are often put at risk by voting restrictions. So is Biden non-committal on this issue?
He seems to be sort of trying to please all parties and effectively pleasing no one. His statements in the past have been that he does not support eliminating the filibuster. He thinks there will be long-term consequences to the functioning of the Senate. At the same time, he sees his agenda stalled and knows that he's facing increasing pressure from the left. But Biden is not necessarily the only one who gets to make this decision. You also need some of these more moderate Democrats in Congress who would also have to be on board with ending the filibuster. Now, Biden could use his bully pulpit to try to lean on some of those members to try to push it a bit more, but it could be that if there's limited return on that investment, the White House may just be making the decision that's not worth putting the president out there on such a controversial issue if there's no hope of it actually making a difference.
And I think it's important to note that President Biden served for decades in the U.S. Senate. This is something, the way this body works is very important, has been a part of his public service for almost his entire life. He was elected as a very young senator. So I think there's a sense with the president that this is something that would really undo a legislative tradition that is very important to how it functions. So that's quite a decision for him to make, even though he's not the only one who is instrumental in making that decision. He could certainly break away from those years of Senate tradition and say, look, this is where we need to go next.
And we will continue to follow developments on this voting rights issue. On now to our next topic, where Senate Democrats say they have reached a budget agreement among themselves that envisions spending $3.5 trillion over the coming decade. The plan includes spending for climate change, health care, and family service programs sought by President Biden. So, Catherine or Kimberly, this is quite an expensive bill. And even the latest development in infrastructure proposal is headed for reconciliation. So how significant is this agreement?
Well, I think the agreement is important because we saw progressive independent Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont come out in support of it and say that, you know, those climate issues that were folded into that piece of legislation have satisfied him. Him coming out and signaling that is important for the support of progressives over in the House of Representatives, where, of course, we know House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has a very narrow margin to work with. She only has about 3 votes that she can lose in order to pass anything on the Democratic agenda. So the fact that he's come out and said that will help lead the way so that Democrats can get this deal through Congress. It's also important to note that they are trying to fold immigration reform into this legislation. Of course, as we know, immigration reform has long been almost impossible to pass on Capitol Hill. I've seen so many deals made and then broken at the last moment up there. So I think that's an important element of this deal to watch as well. Will that be able to be a make or break moment for satisfying some of the issues with immigration law in this country, or will it completely tank the deal completely?
The other interesting part of this deal is it does accomplish sort of some of these Democratic goals of expanding what we consider to be infrastructure. This has been a debate sort of in the last couple of months about what should be included in infrastructure packages in general. So you have, for example, Medicare expansion, including coverage for dental, hearing, and vision care, Medicare being the program, the healthcare program for older Americans. You've got things like rural broadband, and it's not everything the Democrats want, but it is sort of a step along that. And, you know, just useful to emphasize that this is being done through reconciliation, or it's planned to be done through reconciliation, which is this budget tactic that allows them to get around that 60-vote threshold that is standing in the way of what we were just talking about with voting rights legislation.
Yes, and that brings me up to a next thought. Will Senate Democrats be able to circumvent a GOP filibuster using the so-called reconciliation process, the same move that Democrats used to pass the president's $1.9 trillion pandemic aid package back in March?
That's right. So that's actually up to someone who is rarely discussed up until these past few months, the Senate parliamentarian, who is something of a referee for the way the U.S. Senate works. They decide how this process works and whether or not it's, you know, in a way legal for the U.S. Senate to do. So in a way, that person has come to have incredibly important power in these last few months to pass through these major deals. They will make the decision on whether or not this can go through.
Kimberly.
With the Senate parliamentarian, it's such an enigmatic figure in all of these negotiations, basically making the decision about what falls into this very narrowly defined pathway of having, you know, an impact on the budget in such a way that it should get around the traditional 60-vote threshold. It's sort of a tool that's being stretched to its maximum use in this political environment.
And we will take a quick break now. And when we come back, we'll look at some major developments in two island nations. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panelists who are joining me via Skype, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, and Catherine Gibson, VOA congressional correspondent. Well, Kimberly, Haitian police have arrested one of the suspects' masterminds behind the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. What do we know about suspect Christian Emmanuel Sanon?
He seems to have been someone who has been speaking out publicly for quite some time about his problems with the Haitian government. He has some YouTube videos claiming that Haitian officials were stealing island resources and calling for the government to basically be overthrown. He had apparently, and all this stuff is still coming out and details are pretty sketchy, basically went to Haiti and recruited some commandos or mercenaries to carry out this attack. Again, still under investigation. The group that has been arrested includes more than two dozen Colombians, some Haitian Americans, and the U.S. government has been, as you mentioned at the top of the show, asked to send troops. They're reviewing that request, but at this point, the U.S. government seems like the amount of support they're willing to lend is helping with this investigation. And so that means things like tracking down phone records, who booked what flight, who paid for what, how were people recruited, who knew what when. All of these things are still under investigation, while at the same time, the country is really in turmoil with a bit of a leadership vacuum at the top, even though there is sort of a leadership structure there. It's under duress with lots of competing interests as to who should be running the country in what was already a pretty tense political environment.
Catherine, what are they saying there on Capitol Hill?
This puts the U.S. Congress in a bit of a tough situation, particularly the members of the Florida delegation. You know, there are a lot of Haitian Americans who reside in Florida, so this is an important issue for their constituents. Most members of the Florida congressional delegation are calling for the U.S. to monitor the situation closely, but there's not a lot of appetite, as Kimberly mentioned, for the U.S. to send troops in to this situation. We actually have a broader discussion going on Capitol Hill right now about the repeal of the authorization for military force that have been in place for more than two decades, authorizing U.S. military action in Iraq and Afghanistan. There's a real sense that the U.S. needs to have closely thought out, targeted military intervention in countries around the world. So with that debate going on, I don't think that there's a lot of appetite for the U.S. getting involved in Haiti at this moment.
And also in this investigation that they're doing, how did assassins get by security?
Well, this is part of the ongoing investigation, this question of the president of Haiti did have a security detail. None of them seem to have been injured while he was murdered and his wife was severely injured and she was airlifted to Florida in order to get treatment and seems to be recovering. But that is just part of the investigation. So many threads, so many questions, and the investigation is being done in an environment where fingers are being pointed at some of the top leaders in the country, many of whom were vying for power or jockeying for authority. And so that does complicate the investigation. And that is probably also one of the reasons why the U.S. seems more willing to contribute intelligence resources than military resources.
So we'll have to continue following and covering the investigation and the effects of this assassination on Haiti. On now to Cuba, where thousands of people took to the streets to protest over food and medicine shortages, price hikes, and the government's handling of COVID-19. President Miguel Díaz-Canel's government blames the U.S. and its economic sanctions for both the protest and Cuba's wider problems. So in looking at this, I'll throw this out to both of you all, Catherine and Kimberly. President Biden expressed support for the people of Cuba. Will Biden's support of the protesters hurt or help his political interests there?
Well, that's a really important question, given that there are so many Cuban Americans who live in the swing state of Florida, which we know is important to U.S. electoral politics. So a lot of Democrats are saying that this is a moment where Biden can really win over the state of Florida. And a lot of House Democrats have spoken out and said, we need to take more action on this issue. I've been speaking to a lot of Republicans on Capitol Hill. I just spoke with Republican Senator Marsha Blackburn about the Biden administration response in Cuba. And she said that she thinks the president is trying to have it both ways, where he's pleasing Cuban Americans, but also not trying to offend anyone. She said that this is actually an issue where the U.S. Congress can take some substantive action. You know, the U.S. funds these open source technology programs that allow Cubans to circumvent internet restrictions so that they can get that all-important information out over social media channels that have been blocked up until now by the Cuban government. The Cuban government controls the only telecom network in the country, and they have been shutting down the internet to try and prevent protesters from communicating with each other through social media and getting out the information to the rest of the world so that there's transparency about these protests. Republicans up on Capitol Hill and Democrats up on Capitol Hill have actually worked together on this issue, and they're saying that those open source technology tools are working to help Cubans get out the word about these protests.
In talking about the Cuban Americans, especially those living in the southern part of Florida, as you mentioned, they really want to see the U.S. take a more aggressive approach against the communist leadership in Cuba. So, Kimberly, where do you think the U.S. stands in their minds?
I think it circles back to the conversation that we just had about Haiti. It's what does that look like? Does it look like more sanctions, which could, in theory, give the Cuban government more fuel for this argument that the United States is what's behind all of these shortages and an uncomfortable way of life in Cuba? Does it look like military action, which has famously been pretty disastrous when it comes to the United States and Cuba. Does it look like improved diplomatic ties? All of these are different ways of trying to address the relationship with Cuba, which has been pretty up and down throughout the last few years. You know, we had under the Obama administration an opening of the relationship with Cuba, increased tourism, increased travel. The Trump administration pulled way back on that and ended many of those agreements. And now the Cuban government also has had its own round of changes with changes in leadership, and for the first time in decades and in recent years. And so all of these things, it probably is going to take a bit more protesting to see like where the protests coalesce and in terms of demands and how the Cuban government responds before the United States at least is able to make any meaningful change, because as we just discussed, there's not a ton of appetite for U.S. military involvement abroad at the moment.
Catherine, as you brought out the Republicans' perspective on this, just to emphasize, Republican Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, he's called on Biden to take concrete steps to help protesters, including setting up free satellite internet access and working with allies in the region and the EU to coordinate a strong rejection and condemnation of the repressive actions taken by the communist regime against the unarmed people of Cuba. And those are Republican Senator Marco Rubio's words there. So how does the international community view Cuba? Is it a priority on the international scene?
Well, I think it's certainly a priority in terms of Republicans on Capitol Hill who, you know, as I mentioned, I was speaking with Senator Blackburn just a few minutes before we started speaking. She thinks that President Biden has been very good at saying the right things, but he really needs to back that up with action, like Senator Marco Rubio said as well, that we really need to take concrete steps, including sanctions against the Cuban government, to really reinforce that the U.S. is watching this situation closely, that it is very important on an international scale, and we need to send a strong message that we are going to support those Cuban protesters.
Okay, we have just a few minutes remaining, and I wanted to get a quick comment from the both of you on the violence that is taking place in Afghanistan. For instance, a video obtained by CNN this week showed the Taliban executing 22 Afghan commandos as they surrendered. This has exacerbated criticism of the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan ordered by President Biden. And seeing this type of violence and other violence taking place there now, did the U.S. expect this with the troop withdrawal?
It seems like this was going to be the inevitable outcome with the Taliban. The Taliban was already gaining in power, and you had, frankly, demoralized Afghan troops all over the country, many of whom are just choosing not to continue the fight without the support and backing of the United States. That leaves many of the people who provided support to the U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan in quite a dangerous situation, either because they can't get out of the country, it's not possible for them to get the information or connect with those who could help them get out of the country. And the Biden administration is being pretty firm that the United States does not need to be in the business of nation building in Afghanistan, and that this has been the long war, the longest war, and it's time to end it. And it's hard to imagine a scenario when a U.S. withdrawal would not have caused this kind of devastating outcome. But at the same time, the Biden administration seems pretty committed to getting out of Afghanistan.
That's right. And you know, when you talk to lawmakers up on Capitol Hill about this withdrawal, there's a sense that, well, it was inevitable that the U.S. find a way to end this longest war. There was some frustration among Hill Republicans that Biden really hamstrung the U.S. by announcing an end date, by setting that symbolic date of September 11th, which we know the U.S. will actually withdraw well before then, that this really sent a really poor message to Afghans and sent a message to the Taliban that we were completely surrendering. But in the end, there's some acceptance up on Capitol Hill that this was really the only solution for the U.S. and Afghanistan. And that, of course, has sparked that broader conversation about congressional authorization of force in Iraq and Afghanistan, those two decades-old pieces of legislation, which had given U.S. presidents very broad powers to conduct war overseas. Those are going to be repealed on Capitol Hill probably within the next week or two.
We're going to have to end the show on that note. My thanks to panelists Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, and Katherine Gibson, VOA congressional correspondent. I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for joining us for Issues in the News.